Welcome to another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable, where real people share real stories, and together we crush stigmas one episode at a time. We're coming to you straight from the Rio Grande Valley, the front line of the USA, where Texas meets Mexico, separated by the Rio Grande River. I'm your host, Rico ATP, and riding shotgun is Mr. Roland Reyes, and of course, the Quad Father. We're just two ATPs in a quad with a mic, a mission, and a whole lot of passion. This podcast is all about real people, real stories, and real power, spotlighting life after injury, adaptive technology, and the voices reshaping what it means to roll forward. Buckle up, because at this roundtable, we're not just talking, we're building a movement. How you doing, Roland?
I'm doing good. How was your week, Rico, besides texting me 46 times this week?
Good. Was out to a new territory, calling out some accounts. It looked super promising.
That's right.
So I'm going back out there next week. It was really, really good, man.
Good.
How about
we,
you?
We won't name that territory.
No, remain.
Dude, I had a solid work week. I got to spend 2 days at home working on paperwork and Brightree and clinics, evals, gait trainers, walkers, wheelchairs, custom, not so custom, different things. Had a great week. It felt really, really good.
Good, man.
Yep. Danny?
I went back to work. My summer is over. Teachers at my school district are back. So, and then I celebrated my birthday on Wednesday.
Happy birthday, dude.
Happy quad father.
I didn't know. We just became friends on Facebook this week, so I didn't know.
That's all right. But yeah, it was good to be back at school and see all the teachers after their break. Good times.
Yeah. I'm sure you're just as excited as the kids in your class, dude, when your first day. Do you have that same first day energy?
I do. I'm like, I've already worked on my first 3 weeks of what I'm going to do, changed my room around. I got some new toys to play with this year. So yeah, I'm ready. I'm always.
Do you have every student's name memorized already?
Not yet, but I'll do it within the first 2 to 3 days. Yeah,
that's pretty amazing.
2 days?
No way, man. Yeah. I couldn't do it.
That's like 180 people. No, somewhere around there.
Well, since I have the college class, I have a lower number of kids. So I have I'm in the like 60 to 70 range. But back in the day when I did food science, that was about 160 to 170 kids. That took a little bit longer. Yeah.
I have to verbally go through my mental Rolodex with trying to remember each kid as I'm talking to them, to my children. Yeah, I'll call them 3 different names before I get to their name.
Same here.
Yeah.
Well, Danny, what kind of feedback are you getting for House Bill 1481? For those that don't know, the state of Texas has banned cell phones in public schools. What have you heard, Danny?
So we had our training on that yesterday, and I didn't know it was going to be as tough as it is on paper. When they say no, I thought it was just going to be no phones, but now it's no tablets, like no Apple Watches or like Meta glasses or anything that you can communicate with. I thought it was just going to be phones, but I get it. You can still communicate in other ways. The kids are always going to find a way, no matter what, to be able to kind of chat with each other. But yeah, and it's to the extent where now not even during the break. So lunch, no phones. In between, you know, passing period, no phones. I didn't know it was going to be that in depth. I just thought, you know, during class, nothing. But yeah, I get it. There's been instances where, you know, I've heard other schools where there's fights going on and kids bust out their phones and all this information starts to come out and some of it's false. And then parents start to hear it and people start to freak out. So I get it.
It almost feels unsustainable, the new rule.
Yeah. What they're going to do with us, I know some school districts have had it in the past, but we didn't have phones in our room before, but it was just like one phone per department, like down, you know, in the teacher's lounge or whatever. But now we're all going to have phones in our classroom. So if there is emergencies, there's a way for us to get, you know, let people know in the outside world, right? But I don't know. We'll see how it goes and see what things
are. So where are phones actually going? In backpacks or pockets, or are they allowed? Like,
they're supposed to be off and in their bags.
If they bring them in their bags. Totally off.
Totally off, yeah.
That's rough.
I mean, I know there's going to be certain exceptions, especially with kids, like certain disabilities where they need it for some reason. I get that. And that's going to be, we're going to have to figure those things out. One thing I have to figure out is I teach a college class and we've done experiments where we need a phone. So how am I going to figure that one out? And I've got my meeting tomorrow with a college I work with and how they're going to navigate that. But yeah, it's going to be interesting this year to see how that goes.
Interesting.
Yeah, I asked my son and my daughter because they're freshmen and junior at Mac High. And I said, well, what's going on? They said the teachers don't care if they're still using their phones. I'm like, are you serious? Like, you're not going to get in trouble? And apparently right now it's not being enforced that some of the students are still walking the hall with their,
I can imagine that it's a double-edged sword, you know?
Well, what are you going to do with those kids that they're going to go through withdrawal.
Yeah.
And you're not going to have that dopamine feedback looking through, scrolling and scrolling, doing that doom scrolling. Yeah. So what's going to happen there?
I die just from not being on TikTok, dude.
You're just going to have to learn to talk to each other or something. I'm not sure.
But my whole thing is, what if something were, you know, God forbid were to happen and I need to get in touch with my kid? You know, I mean,
you can call the school. This is a tough topic.
I know.
Because I grew up in a different generation where things like this didn't exist. Exactly. Or problems like this didn't exist.
Well, you and I.
Yeah. But me more.
I mean, well, yeah. As far as I know, the teachers are still allowed to have them there. I'll have mine there. I need it, you know, medically. I need my phone because there's certain things I can't do. But
right.
And the kids and their parents are going to have my number because it's part of the college thing. I put it out in the syllabus. So, and they, you know, they
if need the me. Bell rings, so the bell rings and now you're good, or how does that work?
No, not even passing period. Not even lunch. Yeah, I don't. So that the lunch thing is going to be tricky. I don't know how they're going to monitor all those kids during lunch. And the phone, I expect that to be the tricky part. In class, we can do a good job. We started last year with, you know, completely put their phones away or in the pockets in the door. So a lot of our students are already used to that, but they were still on. Yeah. Now to have them away and off, that's a different ballgame.
Rich problems we have nowadays.
You know.
It's a tough topic, dude, without a doubt.
About the kid at lunch.
Eager to see how that plays out. Over time.
Agreed. You're going to have to keep us up to date, Danny. I'm pretty sure this is just the start of some huge topic that's going to come up in a couple of months.
We have an interesting guest today, fellas.
Oh, yes, we do. Today we have Dr. Allison Kyrell. She's a physical therapist, a good friend of mine, and one of the most favorite people that I know on this planet. So Allison, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Allison. Like Rico said, I'm a physical therapist, and you know, I've had the pleasure of working with him for the past year or so. So it's been really great. I'm from Harlingen, Texas, so I'm from the Valley. I grew up in an environment where my parents encouraged me to, you know, explore a wide range of interests, from sports like tennis and softball to activities like chess, dancing, acting. So I think that background really influenced my desire to pursue a profession where I can empower people to improve their health through their own bodies, while also giving me the opportunity to maintain a creative outlet. I received my bachelor's degree in kinesiology with a pre-PT concentration at Texas A&M Kingsville. While I was there, I really tried to get as much experience as I could. I joined health science clubs, took leadership roles in my sorority. I was part of the Honors College. I shadowed at PT clinics. I got involved in research. And I even got the chance to study abroad. I went to Puerto Rico. So it was pretty exciting. I also worked at the Campus Rec Center as a personal trainer and a group exercise instructor, which gave me some good hands-on experience helping people with their health and fitness at that point. And then I applied to PT school the year prior to graduating. And, you know, I got all of my prerequisites during my bachelor's degree. I applied to a couple different places. UT Health and Texas Tech were the two main ones that I wanted to get into. And after doing my interviews with both of them, I really liked the way UT Health in San Antonio kind of geared their program towards creating a cohort that got along. There were two group interviews and two individual interviews. So I feel like they really got to create a class that worked well together that way.
Allison, for somebody interested in pursuing physical therapy as their profession, their undergrad, I know you got kinesiology. Are there other types of degrees that they can get and then apply to the school?
Yeah. So I had several classmates that had a variety of different degrees. So it is a prerequisite to have a bachelor's degree, but the type of degree doesn't matter. One of my good friends, Gabe, who actually worked at DHR with me, he had his major in graphic design. So as long as you do your prerequisites, which include physics, chemistry, there's a couple other things that as part of those prerequisites, as long as you do those and you have your bachelor's degree, you can apply. And I think it's great because having people from all those different types of backgrounds, I think, gives like more diverse opinions and like input. So Gabe is one of the best PTs that I know. And so I think, you know, it comes from that different background.
What was your experience like moving up there for the first time alone? I'm assuming you were a young single lady alone.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, how that worked out.
Yeah. So I was actually really lucky. UT Health Science Center They have a medical program and they have a dental program as well, nursing, OT. So one of my best friends, she was actually in the dental program at the same time that I got into the PT program. So we roomed together for the first couple of years. And then I, after she got married, I moved out and I lived by myself for a couple of years. But it was, I've always enjoyed my independence. So I think I really got to make the most of it. I made really good friends with my class and, you know, got to explore San Antonio.
How long was the program?
3 years.
3 years?
Nice. So during your time when in the deep PT program, were there any professors or mentors that had a lasting impact on you?
Yeah. So my neuro professor, Dr. Selena Morgan, she's just an inspiring individual. She taught both of our clinical neuro classes. So she really leads herself with like a lot of passion. She did pro bono work. I think just that is the type of therapist that I'd like to be. Passionate and caring. Just she's all of those things.
Yeah, I've met her a couple of times.
Have you really?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, she's great.
Okay, so looking back, is there a lesson or value from your DPT program that still guides you today?
Wow, that's good. Let me think. I think just trying to do your best and for every patient, you know, making, if you don't know about something, finding the resource to solve that, you know, that challenge. Gosh, that's a really good one. I'd have to think about that one a little longer.
We can come back to that one. Yeah. So what valuable lessons did you learn when you were doing your rotation?
So we have 4 different rotations. One of them was in neuro, one was in ortho. One was in acute care, and then our 4th was a specialty of our choice. So I chose to do mine in pediatrics, and then I also got to work in the NICU with the babies. So gosh, I feel like each one had their own lesson that I got to learn. but just seeing people from different backgrounds and being able to come at a challenge from different angles, because every patient is different. And every setting is different. Physical therapy really kind of has a large span that it covers. So each setting really has a different type of patient population.
Okay. So tell us about your first job when you first got into the workforce.
Okay. Yeah. So my first job out of PT school was actually at Valley Baptist in Harlingen. I was working in the acute care setting. So in acute care, physical therapy is when in the hospital where patients are admitted for surgery, illness, or injury. The focus is early mobility, restoring basic function, and preventing complications, and also preparing patients for a safe transition to the next level of care. So as a PT in acute care, my main responsibilities were evaluation and discharge planning. And it was a valuable learning experience, but I did realize that I wanted to build like a longer term relationship with my patients. And that's when I reached out to SJ at DHR at Neurotherapy Institute. And I asked her about how she liked it there. And she recommended me to our director, Mike, and I've been there ever since.
Nice. So tell us about DHR outpatient clinic.
Yeah. During our call yesterday, you mentioned that you were very specific that you're an outpatient therapist. Tell us a little bit about inpatient and outpatient, the differences for everybody to understand a little bit better.
Uh-huh. So when I was working in acute care, like I said, our main focus was discharge planning. So we were determining if patients were safe to go home or if they needed to be discharged to a skilled nursing facility or if they were appropriate for inpatient rehab. And we were also involved in determining equipment for, you know, whatever they needed. And so something that I had mentioned yesterday, just a lot of people at that hospital did not qualify for inpatient rehab. And so, you know, typically a lot of people were sent either to a skilled nursing facility or home, and I would be recommending equipment for them. And one of my biggest lessons that I learned now that I'm an outpatient is I was recommending wheelchairs for a lot of people. And a lot of the times they're going home, and, you know, no one was educating them on the fact that that rinky-dink wheelchair that we're giving them from the hospital, as if they have it for more than a year, they're stuck with that for the next 5 years. So I think there needed to be some changes. Now that I know that, I would definitely go things about things differently if right. I was to go back to acute care, because, you know, I now realize how detrimental it is to patients not having that appropriate custom seating that they're going to need for as their primary source of mobility.
Allison, it's Daniel. I have a question about like the time that you're, you know, you see patients for a certain amount of time, right, when they're fresh out of the out of an injury, right? Mm-hmm. And then now you're seeing them after a couple of, you know, months or a year or whatever it is after their injury. What are like, I know that you can see some, like sometimes it feels like you're rushed. I know I hear that a lot from, you know, because of insurance or whatever, right? So tell me about some of those challenges, like, because you've got to teach these patients what they need to know, right? So when they're going home, right? What are some of the challenges that you face when it comes to that kind of stuff?
So as an outpatient therapist, I think all of this planning, I mean, as a therapist in any setting, you start thinking of goals right from the beginning. What do they need? What do they need? Equipment and kind of getting all of that started at the beginning of their plan of care. Because like you said, for some people, they're limited. For Ambiter, for example, they're limited to 35 visits a year. So, we're kind of under the gun to get all of these things done in a certain amount of time while also addressing their physical impairments. So with that, when we do the evaluation, you want to obtain a thorough history. So you're getting the mechanism of injury, their primary complaints, their goals, their past medical history, any like falls, visual impairments, bowel and bladder pressure injuries, their prior level of function. So their mobility, their activity level, their occupation, their household and community roles. And then from there, you determine their current level of function, right? And so what does their home environment look like, right? What is their family support? And what equipment do they have available at their home? So from there, I start kind of getting my scripts together to send to the doctor if they need any kind of equipment. And then also I need to start looking at if they're appropriate for occupational therapy or speech therapy as well. If they have any kind of deficits, including like upper extremity strength, coordination, affecting their ADLs or speech, swallowing, cognition deficits. So all of that, taking a strong history, will kind of help us plan for the future and make sure things are done as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, I remember being there that first, you know, the first time in therapy. It's like, oh no, what's coming? How long am I going to be here? Am I going to get to learn what I need to learn?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because like you said, checking everything that they have at home is probably one of the biggest things, because I know from talking to friends and or families of friends, or when I've gone to talk to patients that are in the hospital that are fresh after an injury, a lot of the questions I get is like, how are we going to do this at home, right? Or what, you have everything at the hospital. When you get home, all of those things are not there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. No, and what I tell people, I feel like therapy is just practice for home, right? So we're kind of problem solving alongside patients. Like, we definitely don't have all the answers. And that's kind of the fun part of therapy too, is that you get to be creative and like find solutions in a creative way with the patient's input, you know?
I want to touch about something that you said earlier about when you were, you know, by the time you started working at DHR, right? You had put in, you know, a lot of time with patients and stuff. What was, thinking back, like, how was it meeting that first patient, right? When you were still behind the ears, what was that like? And like, had you been around a patient in the family or something, or is it something that just came natural to you?
Well, I do. I am a people person. However, I don't feel like anything ever prepares you for your first patient interaction as a therapist, because as a student, we do all of these hours, right? And so we've been around patients. We've had all of that experience, but it's always under the guise of, you know, another therapist. So you kind of have that safety blanket as a student. But, you know, there's, for me at least, I felt a lot of pressure when I first became a therapist, because it's on you now, you know, so it's the gravity of the situation is definitely a little bit heavier. So it did take me a little while to kind of create those boundaries for myself and, you know, get used to becoming the primary decision maker on these cases. But now I definitely feel like I've gotten a little bit more experience. I'm definitely still new. I'm only 3 years in, so I learn every day. Yeah.
Allison, when you get a new referral, a new patient, spinal cord injury, what are the things you're looking at up front?
Yeah, so we kind of talked about taking that history, right? So we're getting all of that information. We're planning for the future. And then we go ahead and do a physical assessment, right? So we check their strength, their range of motion, tone, sensation, and then their mobility. So bed mobility, transfers, and ambulation if they're an ambulatory patient. And from there, we'll develop some treatment strategies that will guide the plan of care to address those impairments that we identified during the physical assessment, right? And all of those things that we want to make sure that we're supporting goal attainment, right? So the patient's goals and our goals. So those are kind of the things that I'm thinking about. And we want to make sure those things are very clear because we are also working with physical therapy assistants. So they're going to be helping us along the way. And we stay in constant communication with the team as well to make sure that we're staying on track. And of course, things change as the plan of care evolves. You know, we can't see the future, so things might go differently than we expected. But at that time, we're just making our best educated guess as to what we think can be achieved in that amount of time that we're allotted by insurance.
Gotcha. Now, touching on that, so do you base your treatment plan based on what's approved by the insurance? So in other words, is funding dictating the type of treatment you all can offer?
Yeah. So that's actually something I think that is pretty frustrating for therapists right now. I think, you know, because we are, for some insurances, that does dictate the amount of time that we are able to spend with a patient. And for others, it's a little bit more flexible. So that definitely does play a role into the amount of visits that we request. So say a patient is limited to a certain amount of visits a year, we'll kind of decide, for example, if a patient is more acute, meaning their accident has just occurred, they're freshly out of inpatient rehab, and they have a good prognosis for meeting their goals, we'll probably request a higher frequency of visits of, you know, for example, 3 times a week for 6 weeks, right? Whereas, you know, others that have been dealing with this condition for a longer period of time, and it's more of like a maintenance phase, if they're in limited visits, we'll probably space those out a little bit longer, you know, two for 6 weeks or 1 time a week for, you know, 8 to 10 weeks, depending on their needs. But it definitely plays a role. It's always in the back of our mind. We don't want to utilize all the visits at once, but sometimes it's necessary when it's a more acute patient.
After your initial assessment, and you're writing your plan of care, adaptive equipment, I'm assuming it has been assessed. That goes into the plan of care, correct?
That's one of the things that, you know, as soon as I submit my eval, I am submitting the script, the recommendation for whatever adaptive equipment we might need.
Because standard, that could be anything.
Yeah, that process takes quite a while just because we have to send that off to the doctor, right? The doctor needs to sign it. And then from there, we send it off to whatever company that we're using for that equipment, right? And then insurance as well, right? But insurance usually comes after. Yeah. So it sometimes takes a little while to get that signature back from the doctor. And then after that, if we are getting a wheelchair, we need to do the wheelchair assessment with you guys, the ATP. So getting that scheduled, and then after that, writing the evaluation with y'all's help. And then we have to wait for insurance, right? So quite a lengthy process, right, as y'all know.
How often are you involved in the delivery of this equipment? Because sometimes it can be up to 90 days, 100 days. It could be a while sometimes.
Yeah,
we've done pretty well, though. We've done pretty well, right?
Yeah, we're doing good.
Yeah, but sometimes it could be a while. Are you often left without being able to see the client after delivery, where they're not getting therapy at the moment?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. Yeah, I actually have not. I usually don't get to see the fruit of our labor. Which is why I really appreciate, you know, you guys following up on that. It's, you know, I've built a really close relationship with Rico and then Michael as well. So I follow up, and you guys are really great at keeping me in the loop on, have they gotten it? How does it fit? All of those things. Because again, yeah, sometimes these people are limited on their insurance, so they're not in therapy anymore. But it is great when they do come back to therapy the next year, or, you know, whenever they get more visits, because they have that independence because they're in the appropriate equipment. So
100%.
Yeah.
So Allison, you had mentioned you want to ask us some questions as the ATP. We're really excited about that because nobody asked us any questions. We're the ones asking questions. So shoot.
I have some questions. So my question was, is there anything PTs often overlook that would make your job easier or lead to better outcomes for patients?
Rico's going first.
I'm thinking, man, you should go first. For me, it's education. It's my job is to educate and support the therapist as far as the equipment and what works. I work under the direction of the therapist. Now, sometimes I've come into where I've done wheelchair clinic with a therapist who really isn't strong with seating and positioning, and they don't seem too interested in learning seating and positioning. I'm not comfortable. I can do it. I'm comfortable with my skills. And I know if I have a question, I have you, Roland, I'll come to you. But I prefer, like, for example, when I was in Houston and Tier, I had some therapists that would tell me, I want this, I want that, I want this. And I was just like, yes, ma'am, or yes, sir. And we write it up. Because we know what the wheelchair can do and we can design it. But getting some feedback from the clinician is, it's so huge. It's such a huge value to us. What do you think, Roland?
I think, again, like you mentioned earlier, educating every therapist that we deal with, every clinic, goes a long ways, because what you want is, what you want them involved, the therapist, and to have opinions on it and understand what she wants or he or she wants, so that we're able to execute that. So that isn't always, doesn't always come across, especially when I deal with more like home health agencies and they send out the, you know, it's a one-off.
Yes.
There's not a big interest in what we're doing. And we get a lot of trying to almost lead that evaluation and use our own device, left to our own devices 100%. And there's, of course, not going to be any follow-up from them. So I feel like it's not even any individuals. It's more the system we're in that doesn't allow for that to pay a therapist to take a look at what we've done after the fact. But I think it's super important that you take a look at what we've done, especially the more serious the injury or the disability. I think it's there needs to be some follow-up from OTs, PTs, and clinics in general. But it's hard. Pediatrics, it's a lot easier because you're going to that same clinic. You will be judged, you know? But it's more the adult population and more the outpatient. Yeah. But outside of that, no, I think you guys are great. And it's like Rico said, it's our job to educate you guys as often as we can. And I actually walk around with a pelvis in my car. He's like a passenger. He's strapped in. He's sitting on a cushion. Like, yeah, I pull that pelvis out and just try to, you know, talk about posterior pelvic tilt. Because if your seat depth's off, you're going to see a different kid or adult 4 years later. Mm-hmm. You're going to see the posterior pelvic tilt. You're going to see the kyphosis and the tight hamstrings. And it was caused just from that seat depth being a little bit long, you know, a couple of inches. It'll cause that injury. To me, it's an injury.
Yes.
And it's hard coming after that or behind that and trying to fit them. You open up the seat to back angle, you can do a little bit more anti-thrust, more contours. You need more stuff to stabilize. So yeah,
you start the pelvis.
Yeah. And biangular backs go a long ways. And I think it's a underutilized modification to wheelchairs is a biangular back to pull the shoulders back.
I agree.
Give you lumbar like our vehicles. Mine's got a cool lumbar. And I'm sure Allison's does too, and Danny's. And
yeah.
Go ahead.
Biangular back is just the perfect solution to all of that.
Mm-hmm. For me, I think it's a good opportunity when we get some of these therapists that actually buy in, because when you're working with a therapist, you know when they buy in, when they start getting that passion for seating positioning. And for me, and I know you agree, it's an art. I am designing and building something for somebody they need to use the next 5 years.
It's so important.
It is
so important because they're going home. They're not going to get therapy anymore.
Nope.
Did we do the right thing?
And we follow up. We stick with them. You know, I mean, you've had kiddos that are, what, graduated already?
Yeah.
You followed them from the beginning?
I saw one today that I've had for 24 years.
Tell me about it.
She's a little girl. I can't tell you a whole lot about her, but arthrogryposis. Fused at the knees. And so she's always in a sitting position. In fact, that chair that we have in the warehouse, in the storage, is her old chair. She was a baby.
Is that right?
That mold?
Yeah.
I did a contour U mold on a little 2.5-year-old, I think she was at the time.
Put her on a stroller?
Yeah, put her on a stroller.
Yeah.
But yeah, I saw her today. It was great. Saw the parents.
It was good.
Gave them a t-shirt. Yes. It was good.
Yeah, so we can go off in the weeds, so we'll stop there. What else you got for me?
What changes or tools could you help speed up the process of getting equipment approved and delivered to patients?
Well,
I think the big thing for what you guys can do to speed it up is you know, the way it typically works, we'll write notes. And then we'll send you the eval afterwards. We'll do our assessment with you. And I always felt that in the past, and this, it's become less possible over the years, but in most of my career, the first 20, 25 years, I would get those things filled out on site, but it's hard to focus on what you're actually doing when we do that, because really you're writing and I'm watching you write. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Typing. And so I don't like doing that anymore either, but to speed things up is just to schedule that eval as soon as, even if you don't have approval. Like, well, you need approval for the doctors for the eval, the actual eval to take place, right? I'm assuming. So
they can bill for it, yeah.
Yeah. So Yeah, that's probably one little hang up, but most of the hang ups are going to happen at the doctor's office. So it's not really a question that you guys cause anything. You guys schedule this as soon as you can and do the eval as soon as you can and then get returning it to us. I always say a week is good, hopefully sooner, but a week is always good. And then the slow end is always usually a doctor's office, but shout out to doctor's offices. You guys do a great service as well.
They do. Yeah. Also, sometimes getting the patient to answer their phone. I have a Houston area code, so that kind of like, I'm not going to answer you.
Yeah.
So text messages and then text messages in Spanish. Just trying to get and communicate with the patient. As far as you guys, y'all do a solid job. Documentation solid. Everything's good.
Thank you.
What we run into situations is the doctor. Some of the doctor's offices just don't get it. They say they fax it. They didn't fax it. We drop it off. Communication is just very bad. There's no ownership of somebody taking, hey, I'm going to get this signed because Miss Betty hasn't been out of bed in 2 years. Let me get this done for you.
Yeah.
That's missing. So it's our job also to explain to them, this is medically necessary. I need you to step up and step up and get this signed for us. So there's different moving factors. And then there's the elephant in the room, the insurance. What does the insurance require? Is the insurance going to ask us a question, an addendum? Why doesn't a lower level wheelchair work? Why can't you use a positioning cushion? Why do you need a pressure relief cushion? Is there a history of pressure sores? Was there a pressure mapping done? We get a lot of pushback, pushback.
Yeah, once you guys identify, this process goes pretty smooth. It's usually stuck at some point between an insurance and a doctor's office.
Pretty much.
So, but you guys do a fantastic job as a whole, as an industry that we deal with. You know, there's one-offs here and there, but you guys do a great job overall.
Well, thank you.
I know you got more questions, though.
Well, I have a question that leads off of that real quick for you guys.
Sure, sure.
What can the patient do? Like me, right? I know you all have done the paperwork. Is it just better for me to take this stuff myself to the doctor and have them?
It happens. I'm actually dealing with that right now. Yeah. 100%. We get you to call. If something becomes problematic to me, I certainly like to get the parents involved to call the doctor's office. A lot of the times it results in me getting what I needed. And I often feel bad that I waited so long to actually do that.
I agree.
But you try to be professional, not be like telling on people and stuff like that when it comes to that stuff. But sometimes you've got to say it's a doctor's office. It's been there for 2 weeks.
Yes.
You know,
I recommend when I'm doing especially something complex to set an appointment with your doctor, set an appointment with your PCP and tell them to send me for a wheelchair evaluation.
Yeah.
Because it needs to get done. Those days where you would just send an order and the doctor would sign it and send it back now.
Right.
They want to see the patient now so they can bill for the doctor's visit. Yep. What else?
But in an ideal world, I would love to, in an ideal world, Allison, I would always like to deliver in front of you.
Absolutely.
As anxiety that causes, it doesn't matter. It's going to be the best result. You're going to see, you know?
There's this thing called ATP anxiety.
Yeah.
And I actually went through it this week. It's like you design something for somebody and then it arrives and you're looking at it like, oh, is that going to fit?
Yeah.
Is that gonna
fit? In 33 years, Allison, I've never delivered a chair that I just wasn't worried sick because I'm pushing it up the driveway.
I've never thought about that, but that's so true. Like that project that you've been working on and that delivery has a lot of
You know what I look for? You know what I look for? The first is either the patient, the client, or the parents, depending on the age of the person that I'm delivering the chair to. But I look into their eyes as soon as I cross the threshold.
Yes.
Because it's almost instantaneous. I don't like something, or that's not the color I chose, or, you know, but 9 times out of 10. And when we unbox it, I'm like, why did I do this?
Yes.
What's this about? Why is that back so low from Right Designs, that molded back? Why is that so low? And you have to just trust yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. You just have to go with it, put it together, look at the measurements. And 9 times out of 10, they melt in it and we make a few adjustments and it works out. But I've never failed to have that anxiety that, it almost makes me sick the night before, especially if it's something complex.
If it's something like switch drivers, alternative drive, dude, I'm sweating, dude.
Yeah, I've had times where, dude, I'm driving, I'm like, somebody hit me. So I don't have to deliver this chair today. I'm not lying, guys. And it'll never go away. 33 years, many successes as I've had, you know, with few failures, you know, here and there, never does that anxiety go away. So we care. We care a little too much sometimes. And no one ever talks about the little stuff like, oh, Roland was at Walmart at 9 or Rico was at Walmart at 9, getting the chair started, you know, that kind of stuff, aftercare.
Or at the warehouse at 3 in the morning, putting stuff together.
Yeah. Most people don't know that after the fact, we don't make any money and we sometimes we'll go back 10 times Jeff probably doesn't want to hear this, our boss. But yeah, well, I'll go back until it's right, you know, even if it's 4 days in a row, even if I look terrible. It's just, you know, you got to go back.
It's about us getting it right.
Yeah.
Because once we get it right, the look on that client's face and the family, it just changes. Yeah. All of a sudden, I can be out of bed. All of a sudden, I don't have pain. All of a sudden, my heat is going to heal. Yeah. My wound's going to get better. What? I can sit down?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. No, it really does make a difference. I mean, that's their mobility. That's their freedom, you know? Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get back to you now, Ms. Allison. Give us a talking points that you would give somebody who is a new injured patient. And I'm pretty sure Danny can bounce off that too.
Oh yeah, that was going to be some of my questions for Danny actually. So, you know, when we do the evaluation, typically when we're an outpatient, we have, if someone had a spinal cord injury, they're coming to us from an inpatient rehab. And so they've spent probably about a month there learning kind of how to deal with this new injury, right? But I always like to ask some follow-up questions to make sure that something's recovered during that time. And if they're still not feeling confident with it, you know, what can we do moving forward to kind of bring that confidence and deal with these issues they may still be having? So some of the main points that I look for during the history is, do they know about autonomic dysreflexia? And I know you guys have talked about this in previous episodes, but it's just shortly, it's when a noxious stimulus happens below the level of injury. So it could be something like a full bladder, tight clothing, a wound. And basically, there's a signal from the body that can't travel past that lesion in the spinal cord to the brain. So you get an overactive sympathetic response, and the autonomic nervous system below the level of injury activates, causing basically a dangerous rise in blood pressure. And so the brain senses the high blood pressure and sends signals to slow the heart and dilate the blood vessels above the injury. And this can't overcome the sympathetic response. And so a lot of people would think like, oh, lay someone down when this happens, because that's what happens when you get low blood pressure. But in this case, we are having high blood pressure. So initially you want to sit right, and then you want to start looking for those triggers, right? So is the catheter kinked? Are they having some constipation? Have they not been able to go to the bathroom in a couple days? Do they have any pressure sores, ingrown toenails, or tight clothing? Or sometimes it even happens from muscle spasms. And then I'm sure Danny can kind of bounce off of this and tell us a little bit more about his personal experience with this.
Yeah, the only time I had a major one was when I had, but that was during a procedure when they put the suprapubic catheter in.
Okay.
But I was in the hospital when that happened. But since then, anytime I come close is, you know, once a month when I do change that catheter out, it does, you know, you're removing this thing from right from your bladder, right? And then you're introducing something new. So I always get that because it presents itself in weird ways to everyone, right? Like for me, if I start to feel the beginnings of that pressure, like I'll get the goosebumps, right? Or my face will get a little flush. Right. And I know at some point, you know, if it keeps going after a certain amount of time, you've got to watch out. But you're right. It can happen with the smallest thing. Right. I remember one time I started to spasm really bad and I felt my blood pressure starting to go up a bit. Right. Because you kind of have to learn to listen to your body. Right. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And I eventually said, hey, mom, take off my shoe. Let's just check. And there was a piece of like a sharp rock that my foot was on. It was just a little pebble, but it was there all day. Something tiny like that can, you know, can trigger that. And it just all of a sudden, right? It's been there all day. And then boom, it just increased blood pressure. And, you know, you have to do what you got to do. And yeah, don't lay down, right? Sit up, or you've got to stand or somehow get up and standing, because that brings your blood pressure down. Because it's one of those things that I know for most spinal cord injury patients, right? They just drill that into your brain. Just, you know, you have to watch out for these things and pay attention to your body.
Yeah.
I've had several in the past, dude, clients that the cushion I chose for them, or we chose together, ended up triggering this.
Really?
Yeah. Gosh. Multiple times it's happened to me. Yeah.
Wow.
We had to switch them back to what they had before. And it was usually taking someone off a Rojo, which is, I know now, is just don't do it.
Keep them on the Rojo.
Yeah. Yeah. Generally, not a rule of thumb, but generally, if you're on a Rojo, dude, I'm not taking you off.
Well, like, for me, if it works, don't change it.
Yeah. I'll vote against it for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So typically, yeah, during the evaluation, I'll ask them if they know what that is. And, you know, I'll explain it to them. But if they do know what it is, and I'll ask them, what are your symptoms when you do start to experience it? That way we can kind of, if they are in therapy and they start having this, I'll kind of know more or less what they typically start to feel when they are having autonomic dysreflexia, but some other things I'll touch on also is just pressure relief, right? So, you know, different people, if you're chair, right, you can either do some leans side to side or forward, or even like a tricep dip. And my rule of thumb is typically for at least 30 to 60 seconds, just to allow the blood flow to return to your, you know, ischial area. And then with bed mobility, same thing, if you're laying down in a bed, if someone is bed bound, typically you want to be changing every 2 hours, but in the chair, they say every 15 to 20 minutes, more or less. Danny, how often do you tend to pressure relief and how do you do it?
I do it randomly all day, every day. So I am always just kind of squirming around in my chair, leaning forward off to my side, lifting, you know, pushing off. I have enough tricep to push off my wheels straight up and I can, like I'm doing one right now, but hey, I can do it for, you know, 5 seconds and then I'll hold it and then I'll come back down. And then about 10 seconds later, I'll go back up, right? Because, you know, they usually say do about 15 seconds, but it's a little hard for me to do a full 15 seconds. So I can do it in increments. Mm-hmm. I will shake my legs a bit to make them spasm, which helps out a lot. But every day, all day, because my students ask me, like, why are you always like, they're curious and they're like, why are you always like pushing yourself off? And I'll let them know I'm just getting off my butt, right?
Yeah.
It brings it and it's a question that I always forget. If you're afraid that you might have like a sore, how do you check? Like, I remember you just push up against it. If it turns white or red, or how does that go? I always forget.
In terms of like checking for sores?
Yeah, yeah. I remember somebody, or maybe it was a therapist that said, if you think you've got a spot, if you kind of push up against it and it stays red or it stays white, you have to be careful, or I forget how it goes.
Honestly, I have never heard that. That is, but I would think if it stays white, that's probably not a good sign, because then you're not having good like capillary refill. So like you're not, the blood's not returning to the area in fast.
Yeah.
But yeah, typically I'll ask people if they, and then I'll also ask people if they have any current pressure ulcers or a history of that, right? Because anytime that you have a pressure ulcer, I can't remember the percentage, but Mike told me one time, but you're more likely to have a pressure ulcer in that same area because the skin never returns to the same durability that it was previously. So you always want to kind of prevent yourself from getting them. But I don't know, to me, it just seems like something that's inevitable, but you try to prevent from having them as many times as possible. And then another thing I like to ask about is their bowel and bladder program, if that's something that they were taught in inpatient rehab. In an outpatient clinic, it's not really something that we're set up for. It's quite the production from what I've heard. In inpatient rehab, I've heard they typically do it in the morning or at night, the bowel program, right? And Danny, you could probably kind of speak to this a little more, but I've heard when you're first establishing it, it takes a little while. You might have to take like a laxative or use a suppository, and then you start with your digital stimulation, right? And, you know, typically you'll do some digital stim, you'll allow yourself to defecate, and then from there you'll give yourself another 15 minutes and then you'll go again until you're not having any stool coming out, and then you'll do that daily until, you know, every other day maybe you're only producing stool, right? And so some people do it daily and some people do it every other day. What was that your experience?
Yeah, I learned right away, you know, get on a schedule, right? Are you going to do it in the morning or in the afternoon? And then yeah, like you said, I have suppositories, dig stim for me every day. And that's how my body has gotten used to it. I know some people do it two times a day, three times a day. But it's also, you know, I schedule, you know, I'm very particular about when I eat, right? Not so much what I eat, but so long as I, because I remember hearing, you know, just if you eat, you know, the same time every day, it's not going to really mess up with your schedule much.
Yeah.
And now I'm at the point where, you know, in the morning, I go take care of my business and I'm done, you know, and but it does, I do remember the first time that we did it, because that's how we did it at the hospital, except in the hospital, I used to do it in the afternoons. But when I came over here, I wanted to do it in the mornings because I figured, well, if I'm going to go to school, if I'm going to work, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then less of a chance of having an accident during the day if you do it in the morning. I guess that was my thought process. So about a week and a half before I left the hospital, we switched it over there to the mornings. And the first 2 or 3 days, I was just kind of like erratic. And after about a week, the first week, it finally, you know, boom, 3 days, 4 days in a row. And then I was, you know, and that's been the way it's been since.
Wow.
I know other people will also have like a flaccid bowel. And for that, it's a little bit different. They usually have to just remove the stool physically. But I actually haven't had any patients with a flaccid bowel yet. And then with the bladder, of course, you know, it's typically recommended to do self-cathing either every 4 to 6 hours, or they'll just have an indwelling catheter. Or I also know like the suprapubic catheter, I've heard of that. And then there's another procedure, I forget the name of it, where it's directly in the bladder. And so you can, sometimes they have like a tube coming out of the abdomen or the belly button, and then you can just cath from there. But that's a procedure.
That's different. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. For me, the suprapubic has worked out awesome. It's kind of out of the way. I haven't had too many problems. Eventually, I'd like to try to self-cath, but I know it's going to be difficult because of lack of hand function, but
right.
It's just one of those things that one day I do want to try, but it's just never been a priority. I guess it just depends on what you want to do. Because you're right, every 4 to 6 hours, you kind of have to be aware of that. And, you have to schedule your day. That's one extra thing that I'd have to schedule my day around.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that is one of the biggest things that I was fascinated by when I first learned about this is like, I don't know, every 4 to 6 hours, you have to wake up in the middle of the night. Like, how do you sleep well with this?
Sounds tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I just looked up the name. It's a Mitrofanov procedure. And that's when they, I guess, redirect some kind of tube so you can just catheterize through your abdomen. But yeah, it just depends. Some people, it just makes it easier depending on like dexterity. I feel like as a woman, it might be easier just with the way we're made. I know Victoria kind of talked about that a little bit.
Speaking about Victoria, tell us about her rehab.
Yeah. So I actually came in a little bit later during her plan of care. She was mainly being seen by Christian and Gabe when I first started at DHR, and then I started to work with her, probably at the beginning of this year. And so she was already to the point where she was walking with the lobster and crutches, and then sometimes without them, she was using the AFOs. And so I got to come in at the part where she was a little bit more functional. And so we really just got to drill her with all kinds of stuff. She's up for anything. So I was putting her through the softball workouts, right? So we got to be really creative with her. We were doing, sled pushes, squats, and we even started trying to work on jogging with her in the zero G, which is like a machine that basically sustains the patient from falling. And it can give you some body weight support as well. So she got to practice that without the fear of, falling down, but she's doing pretty well. So I'm excited for her to come back so we can work a little bit more on softball related items.
Her swing.
Batting, that's going to be a hard one, but I know she's up for it.
That was an amazing story.
Yeah.
She's great.
She'll swing a bat, dude. I'm sure.
She will.
Okay, Miss Allison, tell us about Elevate.
Elevate.
Yeah. So, I've been working in outpatient therapy for a couple years now. And something that we often see is we'll see people for their plan of care and we'll take a break with them for whatever reason. It's time for them to be more independent with their exercises or limited by insurance. So we hope that they'll do their home exercise program or, join some kind of gym where they can maintain the gains that they've had in therapy. But oftentimes they come back and we've had some regression, right? Or even while they're in therapy, they aren't exercising outside of therapy because they don't feel comfortable. So that's kind of where I got this idea to open an adaptive gym. And I know this is something that I'd spoken about to Abraham, who's an OT that I used to work with. So I reached out to him and together we came up with Elevate. So it's an adaptive gym. We're starting off small. We're subleasing from an already existing CrossFit gym. And then we're going to order some adaptive equipment to use to make it more feasible for people that don't have hand function or are non-ambulatory. So we'll be doing wheelchair-based fitness where, Danny and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, but some of the exercise will be done in the wheelchair, but it's more based towards those who live their daily life in a wheelchair. So we would also get on the floor sometimes, and then there will be a standing class and then a class aimed towards older adults. So like 55 and over. And then we'll also be offering personal training as well.
Nice. How does that sound to you, Danny?
I'm ready. It's kind of hard to find gyms around here that, you know, I can go work out at, and, you know, somewhere where, you know, it's built for that. And you've got the, you know, you don't have to worry about like, cause it's kind of scary. Like I've been to gyms since like, I'm just there to use some dumbbells or use whatever. Right. But I feel like I'm in the way sometimes, or it's everything's set up weirdly, and you have to kind of like zigzag your way to a part of the gym, finally get there, get through all these people. Right. And, you know, find a place like this that's spaced out properly and it's got the right equipment. You just want to go in there, and it makes you want to go back again. Yeah, it's just one of those things that we really need down here.
I agree.
And I also talked to Danny yesterday. He mentioned something really cool that we hadn't thought about yet. So Danny, you had previously gone to a gym where they gave you like some programming and things to work on, and you were able to do those exercises on your own and then come back and reassess and kind of restructure a plan moving forward. I really like that idea because, you know, some people live a little further away. The Valley's a big place. And so that would be a great way of providing that access to people that aren't close to McAllen, you know?
Yeah, just show them something that they can do at home with some basic equipment, mm-hmm. and get strong. And then, you know, however long that you all determine they should come back, right? See what they've improved and make your alterations to it.
Yeah.
So how does this work, Allison? Is it just one-on-one sessions? Is it a membership?
It might evolve as time goes on, but right now, we're starting off just offering $10 a class, whether it be, you know, the standing or the wheelchair-based fitness. It's going to be $10 regardless. We're looking at a class size of 10 for the older adults class and the standing neuro class. So people with prosthetics or who are living with Parkinson's disease or MS, multiple sclerosis. And then for the wheelchair-based fitness, we're going to drop the class size down to about 6 people. That way we have a little bit more attention and hands-on, which is needed for those classes. And then for personal training, we will offer personal training, which will be one-to-one training. That one will be $50 a session. And some people will only be appropriate for personal training based on, we'll do a short assessment in the beginning to see if people are at risk for falls. Some people might not be appropriate for a group class, and they may be more appropriate for a one-to-one session. But those are kind of our prices. And then we're going to offer, you know, a class pass where you buy 10 classes and it ends up being a little cheaper. It'll be $85 for those 10 classes. And then a personal training bundle where it's $225 for 5 sessions. So that's a little bit less than if you were buying one at a time as well. But initially, we're going to try and have a couple of days where we just offer some free classes just so people can get in there and kind of see what we're about and before they commit, you know.
So if somebody were to sign up, walk us through a session. What could they expect?
So we are actually partnering. We're an affiliate of Kaizen Adaptive Fitness. So they're based out of Virginia. So we're going to be likely their program as a guiding pathway for us. And so from what we've discussed with Emily, who's the founder of Kaizen, is they come in, they do a warm up, you know, and then maybe some mobility. And from there, we'll go into some strength and endurance training. Each class is going to be built around something different with some goal in mind. And then after that, we'll do a cool down session. But if you want to check out their page, Kaizen Adaptive Training on Instagram, I feel like a video would give you a better idea of what it would look like. But every day would look very, very different. But the idea is that it's more based on fitness rather than like a rehab setting.
Where is Elevate located, Allison?
So it's going to be located off of 10th or no, my bad. Nolana and North McCall. It's going to be based out of a CrossFit gym. It's escaping my mind right now. Let me see. CrossFit. Yep. Deepwater CrossFit. That's where we're subleasing from. So it's a pretty big space. They have, you know, the gym owner was very gracious and he was able to show me around. They have actually handicap accessible showers, a bathroom.
Very cool.
Yeah, and some parking spaces as well. And the gym itself is quite large. So I think it's perfect for us to sublease from them for the adaptive gym. So I'm very excited.
Very nice.
Yeah, Emily Kramer Throckmorton. She's the one that's with Kaizen.
Yep, she's amazing. She's been super helpful. Know
how many certifications she has. If you look at it on the website, she's got at least over 20.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. And their board of directors on the website. It's just super cool. I'm so excited for you. So excited for you, Allison.
Thank you.
Yeah, we wish you the very best with that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we are hoping eventually.
What's that, Danny? Guinea pig, throw me in there. I'll try out your equipment.
I would love that. No, I will reach out to you because we're actually, we're shooting promotional content in September, the first weekend of September. So I'll let you know and we'll give you a free shirt and a free workout. If you let us videotape you while you work out.
I mean, I don't know if you want this ugly mug there, but okay, I'll do it.
No, that would be so great. No.
It's going to be the single and available quad father. Hey guys, anything else you want to ask Allison before we wrap it up?
No, I think it was good.
It's good stuff.
I did want to bring one thing up, and it was a thank you to Allison because I don't know if she remembers, but in April, every year I take students that are wanting to be physical therapists or occupational therapists to DHR. I take them to the Neuro Institute. I take them to Nathan there at the hospital, and just so they can kind of see what's going on. And I ended up, some of my kids were asking me about the wheelchair basketball, and they wanted to go check it out. And I took three kids back in April to one of our wheelchair practices. And Allison was awesome with them, gave them some advice, gave them some people to reach out to, but even put them in the wheelchair and got them going, right? Like that's, those kids, like the rest of the time, they were like, it was so awesome. We had so much fun. But that was like the kind of their introduction into like seeing patients in the wheelchair and interacting with them. And I thought that was awesome. And they were so appreciative of it. And so was I.
Thank you. Yeah, they were super great. And they were willing to, you know, help out with everything. So I really appreciated them showing up that day.
You did fantastic. I remember that day. They were really, did such a good job, Allison. You really got their attention.
Thank you.
I want you to talk to somebody who's considering pursuing physical therapy as a career and just give them a bit of advice. And I want you to give some advice to a new grad who's just starting their career in physical therapy.
Oh my gosh. Those are really good. Those are really good prompts. So it was someone applying to PT school was the first one.
Let's say I'm a senior in high school and I'm thinking about going to physical therapy. What would you tell them?
Yeah, no, I would say make sure to, you know, shadow in as many different settings as possible. I think the stereotypical PT is like an ortho PT working with like sports or even like older adults. I don't even think I knew what PT was until I started PT school or even started working. But yeah, shadow in as many different settings as you can, just so you can kind of get a better idea of what this entails. There's such a wide span. I mean, there's neuro, there's ortho, there's pediatrics. There, you can even work in the NICU with the babies. There's pelvic floor, lymphedema. So really kind of see all those things so you can get a better idea if this is something that you want to continue pursuing would be good. I think also for someone who's just graduated PT school, who is going into the workforce for the first time, I think just give yourself some grace. You know, I think, and all of us in our own respective professions can say that, right? I think everyone's a little hard on themselves. You know, you want to do a really good job. And I think just give yourself some grace and try to do the best that you can. And know that if you're always looking for an answer and reaching out to your resources and those things, you're doing the right thing. And that's all you can do.
There you go. All right. Well, Allison, for me personally, I want to say thank you for allowing me to work with you at the wheelchair clinics. You do such a fantastic job. And every time I have a clinic with you, I'm always looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
I've learned a lot from you, so I appreciate all your patience with me.
We appreciate you.
Okay, well, that's going to wrap it up. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable. We'll catch you next time. Thank you.